How shall we study our Old Testaments? It's part two. We were looking at the call of Joshua and how God prepares Joshua for the role that he has. It's a main shift in the Old Testament from the pre-entry into the promised land, all of the promise, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the fulfillments, the wandering in the wilderness. And Joshua actually takes them into the promised land, and Israel's history kind of picks up on a different level. So he's a very key piece in the revelation, the unfolding revelation in the Old Testament. And we've been looking at why God chose him or how God prepared him. And we saw two things from last, I don't know if you remember, but last Sunday night we studied two things. Two foundational lessons learned by Joshua. First, power comes from the Lord. Do you remember? He's fighting the Amalekites. Moses is up on the mountain. Aaron and Hur hold up Moses' hands. When his hands are raised, Israel wins the battle. As soon as his hands come down, Israel starts losing the battle. And Joshua learns right off the bat, power isn't just in military might. Power comes from the Lord. Lesson one. Lesson two, he's up on the mountain with Moses, and God's going to reveal his glory. Joshua is going to see visibly the glory of the Lord. The significance of that is lesson number two, live all of life in God's promised presence. Joshua will not always see God's glory like that. Why is God revealing himself in this manifest, outward, glorious way to Joshua right at the beginning of Joshua's ministry? And the reason is, Joshua is to learn that God's presence is with him in that manifest way, only most of the time he won't see it. So God shows Joshua the reality of his presence and his glory so that Joshua is going to remember, because he's going to have a lot of very ordinary days and a lot of very difficult days leading this army of people. And he has to remember, if he forgets the presence of God, because he won't always see it, God says, here, you see this? This is with you all the time. And so he learns that. I said there were three lessons, and we'd look at the last one tonight. Lesson number three. So power comes from the Lord. Live all of life in God's promised presence. Three, nothing is worse than taking God lightly. Absolutely nothing. What is the worst sin? Think of the evils that exist. Is it war? Is it violence? Is it pornography? Is it immorality? What's the worst thing people do? Look at Exodus 32, 15 to 20. Moses and Joshua are up in the mountain. Now they're coming down. They've been up there, what, 40 days? Moses turned and went down. This is Exodus 32, 15. Went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands. Tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back they were written. Look what it says. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. I would like to have seen how that happened. When Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's the noise of war in the camp. But he, Moses, said, it's not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of the cry of defeat, the sound of singing that I hear. And as soon as he came near the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands and he broke them at the foot of the mountain. Look at this. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and he made the people drink it. Yikes. It's a difficult passage. Moses loses his temper. The people are committing idolatry. The people are made to ingest the gold that they had been worshiping. I mean, the whole thing seems to spin out of control. It just seems like God kind of overreacts to Israel's foolishness. And as Moses and Joshua come down from the mountain, they hear singing in the camp below. And being a military man, that's what Joshua is. The text says Joshua assumes war, verse 17. Now, there's something strange here that we have to make sense of. The strange part of this account is Moses seems to know in advance what's going on at the foot of the mountain, though he doesn't indicate that to Joshua. Because if you back up a few verses from the text we read, look at verses 7 and 8. They're still on the mountain. They haven't started down yet. And the Lord said to Moses, go down for your people when the people are really bad, God says, Moses, those are your people. And then Moses prays and goes, Lord, no, those are your people. It's an interesting thing that they have going on there. The Lord said to Moses, go down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. Look at all the info. Moses has this info in advance. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, Moses knows all of that before he gets into this conversation with Joshua. So the passage is a setup. I mean, it's designed to make us question why Moses doesn't just tell Joshua what's happening. He knows what's happening, but when Joshua has it's war, it's defeat, it's victory, Moses doesn't let on that he knows exactly what's going on. We're meant to ponder Moses' response to Joshua's theories. No, Joshua, it's not the sound of war. It's something much worse than war. It's idolatry. Think about it. All Moses and Joshua hear is singing and shouting. The people aren't suffering. They sound happy. No one is killing anyone. No one's hurting anyone. Everyone's content. We might not have fussed that much about it. But what's happening at the foot of the mountain, in God's eyes, what's happening at the foot of the mountain is worse than warfare, worse than bloodshed, worse than violence. Bloodshed would be better than these worshiping of false gods. This is the reason people have such a hard time with a lot of the revealed truth in God's word. Old Testament and New, by the way. Especially all the violence, the bloodshed, the punishment passages, so many of the wars seem instigated by God himself. And if you think of violence, as terrible as it truly is, anyone who thinks that the ultimate wickedness unfolding in the scriptures is violence is never going to understand the Bible and is never going to understand God, because violence is not the ultimate evil in the scriptures. The ultimate evil in the scriptures, Old Testament and New, is self-rule. God finds that far more offensive than violence. It's the ultimate wickedness humans can create. My value system just constantly collides with a God who views self-will as the ultimate evil in the universe. All the other evils are symptoms of this root. I was looking at James 4:1-5. It's a passage on prayer, but it's more than that. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? What's the root of violence? Is it not this, that your passions war within you? It's in here. Self-rule. My desires, my passions. You desire, do not have, so you kill. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask, and you ask and don't receive because you ask wrongly to spend it. There it is again, your passions. You adulterous people. We know what an adulteress is. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity of God? How serious is friendship with the world? Well, it's the ultimate evil in the scriptures. It's the ultimate evil. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So God is jealous. If I had kept reading verse 5 in James, for my devotion and worship. Now, if I tell you to be devoted to me, you would say, Don's an egomaniac, and you'd be right. When God says, you must be absolutely devoted to me, he's not an egomaniac, he's being compassionate because he's saving me from self-rule, which is where evil and violence and hatred and greed and lust and covetousness, all those things come from lives that aren't devoted to God. So if I say, be devoted to me, I'm an egomaniac. If God says, be devoted to me, me alone, he's saving me. That's the difference. That's the difference. Imagine Joshua's shock. Goodness. He sees Moses, his spiritual father, his spiritual leader, taking the precious law of God that God carved with his own fingers. And he smashes them to pieces in a fit of rage. Joshua is watching. He's saying, something's wrong here. Something's out of control. And remember, Moses already knew. Before he started down, Moses already knew that it was idolatry at the base of the mountain. And he still can't control his anger, even though God's prepared him for it. Joshua gets this great first peep into the kind of zeal for God that he's going to have. I'm sure two thoughts are instantly embedded in Joshua's cranium. A, Joshua sees how Moses punishes the people for this sin. I wonder how many of us, if we had been there and were in Moses' shoes. I mean, I can almost see myself being inclined to say, listen, Moses, I mean, sure, they made a mistake. These are hurting people. They've been wandering a long time. It's not easy waiting when we're up on the mountain that long. I think maybe you're making a bit of a big deal about this. God's gracious. God's loving. I think the people are sorry. Let's move on. This isn't going to help. You're going to make people drink this stuff? What if there's kids? Is anybody going to get sick? Doesn't happen. There's no patience. There's no question. In a flash, Joshua learns something is more terribly wrong here than he's seen before. Moses prayed in the face of battle, the lifted hands. But this sin sent him into a rage. I don't know that there's any other way to say it, but that our world and much of the contemporary church has come to view sin a lot more lightly than God does. I mean, we believe in it. We kind of apologize for it when we fail. We ask Jesus to forgive it. But I'm not sure I'm as overly troubled about it as I need to be. I'm reading this in my devotions. Paul Tripp's got it's kind of a Bible with daily readings. And at the end of the daily readings, he puts some devotional thoughts, okay? And so he's talking about these passages because Old Testament, New Testament, here's the problem, if we're honest. I read my Bible. I read it right through. I have done that a number of times. Old Testament, New Testament, I find God constantly doing things I don't approve of. Anybody else notice that? Go and kill all the Amalekites, men, women, children, wipe them out. Does that bug you a little bit when you read that? Does me. New Testament, Ananias and Sapphira, God strikes them both. There's a church service that people remember. God did it. We read a communion passage where it talks about eating and drinking unworthily, and it doesn't say everybody, but some people have grown weak and some have slept, some have died. It wasn't the devil, it was God. So you see what I'm saying? God just doesn't seem to care about my approval. Why are these passages in there? It's bad PR for sure. That's what Tripp is addressing. This is really small print, so forgive me, but like this is tiny print. It's easy to minimize, deny, or forget the evil that still lives within us and will continue at least in measure until God's redeeming work is complete and we are with him forever. Yes, he has given his children means of grace, such as his Spirit, his Word, his church. But we still must not minimize the presence and power of sin. Think about the following realities. We are still capable of going where lust sometimes leads us. We can still let anger drive our actions, reactions, and responses. We're still able to be consumed by bitterness or jealousy. We not only fail regularly to love our neighbor, but we also give way to contempt. We often love our own way more than God's way. We often seem to love the world more than we love our Lord. I could let this list go on and on. It's clear that our struggle with sin is not over, but something else is just as clear. Sin doesn't always seem that sinful to us anymore. Sometimes what God says is ugly looks beautiful to me. We tell ourselves that we can sin and everything will be all right in the end. Sin is a liar, never keeps its promises, never produces good in us or through us. Sin whispers to us promises of life, but it leads only to death. Sin is more deeply sinful than we tend to think or imagine. So God has recorded shocking moments of history in his word. He wants us to be alarmed, confronted with the horrible nature of sin. That's why those passages are in your Bible. That's why they're there. I just found that really, really helpful. When people turn away from worshiping God, they will turn to worshiping something else that will choke them, and I'm playing on that, grinding it up into powder and making them drink it. Remember, it was God's own people who had done this. I don't think Joshua had ever seen anything like this in Israel. Well, the people had grumbled before, they had complained. They had told Moses that God played a cruel trick on them and they wanted to go back to Egypt. There wasn't enough water. There wasn't enough food. Oh, they had fought. At times they had killed each other. They had lied. There were times when they brought imperfect lambs, remember, as sacrifices. But there they were this time, dancing and singing around an idol. So what does Joshua learn as he watches all the people? Young children, old seniors, young people, all of them gagging, choking, coughing on these shavings of metallic gold. And why did Moses make the people drink it all up? Text doesn't say. I'm just asking, could it be Moses wants the people, and Moses especially wants young Joshua to see how worshiping anything other than God will ultimately make us sick? Is it that we end up always choking on the things that we form to take God's place in our lives? Matthew 22:37-38, Jesus said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. I now see nothing but love in that stern warning. It's the command that keeps us from ingesting all sorts of things that aren't good for us, that aren't made for us, that can never feed us. We should all kneel before the beauty and the moral health of putting God at the center of our lives and being fully devoted to Him. So there are these three life lessons for Joshua. They're for all of us. You want your life to count. They have to be learned. Notice, all of those lessons have to be learned before the promised land can be entered in the Old Testament. He has to learn them before the promised land is entered. God forms people for His promises. He shapes them to be ready to inherit. Three lessons. Power comes from God. Second, all of life must be lived in His presence. Remember it when you don't see it. And third, nothing in all the universe is more wretched and ugly than taking God lightly. Years ago, I can remember reading A.W. Tozer, my favorite book that he wrote, The Divine Conquest. Here's how I'm wrapping up this teaching. Tozer said this, quote, the Christian must deliberately narrow his interests. The jack of all trades will be a master of none. The Christian life requires that we are all specialists. Too many people use up time and energy without bringing us nearer to God. Here's the sentence. If you will narrow your interests, God will enlarge your heart. Oh, that's a money sentence. If you will narrow your interests, God will enlarge your heart. Jesus is Lord seems to the unconverted to be a motto of death, but a great company of happy men and women can testify that it became to them a way into a world infinitely wider and richer than anything they had ever known before. Christ is the essence of all wisdom, all beauty, all virtue. To know Him in growing intimacy is to increase in appreciation of all things good and beautiful. The mansions of the heart will become large when their doors are thrown open to Christ and closed to everything else. Here's the sentence again. If you will narrow your interests, God will enlarge your heart. And everyone said,